You know, in the 10 years I've been working with you, Tom, you have never missed a hard out. This is Movies I Love That No One Talks About. I'm your host, Dan Benamore. Today we're talking about the 2019 film Triple Frontier. The film stars Ben Affleck, Oscar Isaac, Charlie Hunnam, Garrett Hedlund, Pedro Pascal, and Adria Arjona. JC Chandor directed and co-wrote the film. JC also directed Margin Call and previous episode of the show, A Most Violent Year. The film cost $115 million and was released straight to Netflix. It holds a 70% on Rotten Tomatoes. Quickly before we get started, just know we are going to spoil the film. This is your spoiler alert. I have no guests today. My last solo pod was A Most Violent Year, which is also a JC Chandor film. And I feel like Triple Frontier, similarly, is a weirdly introspective, subversive movie instead of the kind of like bang, bang, Fast and Furious movie that I think people thought it was going to be. I actually think it's a movie that you're probably better off watching by yourself. This is not a movie to like crack a beer Friday night at 9 o'clock and fall asleep to. Like, you got to sit and actually pay attention to it. One of the reasons I decided to do this as a solo pod is because I wanted to deep dive into the backstory of the movie, which is wild, and the aftermath of the movie, which is significant. Netflix has changed their business model because of this movie. I'm not sure how long this is going to be. This might end up being a shorter episode because it's just me, but I do think this movie is fascinating and there's a lot to say about it, maybe more than you might think on the surface. So the movie was first announced in 2010 in Deadline. Catherine Bigelow is going to follow The Hurt Locker with this movie. Mark Bowal, who wrote The Hurt Locker, is also writing this movie. And Tom Hanks is talking about the movie with Bigelow, supposedly. Also in 2010, Bigelow is supposedly talking to Johnny Depp about the movie, about him co-starring with Tom Hanks, again, per Deadline. Still in 2010, ComingSoon.net confirms Tom Hanks is going to star in the movie via producer Charles Roven. We're going to get to whether or not that's true, but can you imagine how different this movie is with Tom Hanks in it? I think Hanks should have done it. I love Tom Hanks, but for whatever reason, you know, my personal taste in the movies that he's picked over the last decade have not matched up. If you go back to Saving Private Ryan, Castaway, Road to Perdition, Catch Me If You Can, those are all great movies. They were like events when they came out. It was a big deal when they came out. And then Hanks kind of goes into like The Da Vinci Code, Angels and Demons, very sort of, I would say, impersonal mainstream blockbuster kind of movies. And then prestige dramas like Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, Sully and The Post. Not knocking any of those movies, but I wasn't personally as excited by any of them as I was by his previous films. You have to assume that Hanks would have played the Affleck part, although who knows how similar the script back then was to the finished movie, considering Chandor was not even involved yet. But let's just say for argument's sake, he is in the Affleck part. Isn't that really interesting? Like, we haven't seen Hanks do that. And a lot of people watch this movie on Netflix, but I wonder if it might've been even a bigger splash with Hanks. So for reasons unknown, the movie does not get made, even though supposedly Tom Hanks wants to star in it in 2010. Then in 2015, Deadline reports that Bigelow and Bowal have stepped away to make a movie about Bo Bergdahl. Remember him? Deadline said the most recent rumored casting was Tom Hanks and Will Smith. Again, imagine Tom Hanks and Will Smith in this movie. So I found a Vulture article, which God bless the good people at Vulture. They did a lot of this research for me. They talked to Tom Hanks's publicist, who denied he was ever attached to this movie. Now we're in 2016, moving forward in the timeline of the buildup to this movie. Chandor is directing. Variety reports that Johnny Depp is in early talks to star in the film, and Will Smith had to move on for scheduling reasons. In 2017, Channing Tatum and Tom Hardy are supposed to be joining the cast. Also in 2017, Mahershala Ali is supposedly negotiating to join the cast, and Tom Hardy's deal is done, and Tatum's deal is all but closed. This is per Deadline. So this movie could have starred Tom Hardy, Channing Tatum, and Mahershala Ali. Does Mahershala play the Oscar Isaac part? Is Tom Hardy the Ben Affleck part? You know, the musical chairs of who's playing who is really extraordinary. I love imagining Tom Hardy, who I love dearly, doing that thing he does where he just mumbles and you don't know what the hell he's saying, but he's like somehow the best actor in the movie. I feel like that would have fit in really well with this movie. I wish they could remake this movie with all these different casts. So look, who knows if Vulture is correct, but they cited an unnamed source that says
that Channing Tatum and Tom Hardy hated each other, and that was an issue. Paramount drops the movie in 2017. Initially, I assume the reason that Paramount dropped it was the same reason that Netflix kind of has mixed feelings about it, which we'll talk about at the end of the episode. But it doesn't seem like that's the case. The Vulture article claims that Paramount greenlit this movie at a $60 million budget, which is a lot less than the Netflix budget. Ben Affleck joins and drops out of the movie in 2017, according to Variety. In the summer of 2017, Deadline reports the Triple Frontier is going to start shooting in August with Mark Wahlberg, Charlie Hunnam, Garrett Hedlund, and Pedro Pascal. So that obviously means that Wahlberg is in the Affleck part, which I think would have been interesting. The only reason it's not as effective is because Wahlberg doesn't have the intense personal parallels that Affleck has, which I'll talk about right now. So movie doesn't shoot in 2017. In 2018, Deadline reports the movie is finally going into production. Ben Affleck is back, and Deadline said that he previously withdrew for personal reasons as he dealt with sobriety issues. So this is a big thing that really is there in the movie. In 2017, Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner file for divorce. His divorce is not final until October of 2018. And, you know, we obviously everybody knows that Ben Affleck has struggled with his sobriety. In 2017, he went to rehab. And after production of this film in 2018, he relapsed and went back to rehab. So this movie went into production in March of 2018, which means that while filming this movie, Ben Affleck is in the middle of getting a divorce and he's between two different rehab stints. I think very similarly to the movie The Way Back, which Ben Affleck recently did, you cannot watch this movie without feeling like it's almost a documentary of Ben Affleck's life. Like, it's so close to a lot of the personal challenges that he's faced in his life, and it adds to the movie. I mean, it can't not add to the movie. Chandor in an interview said that his priority is to tell original stories he hasn't seen before. That's also my priority as a viewer. That's what I'm looking for. So I think that's why I dig this movie, but I also think it's why it doesn't work for everyone. Chandor's original cut was supposedly 2.5 hours. They trimmed it by 32 minutes. And specifically, he trimmed after they kill the people in the village. Chandor said, "One of the things I realized in that first screening sitting there was that when that scene happens in the farm field, when the movie, you know, they make a mistake and kill those people, that the audience thought they were kind of watching the fun swashbuckling thing up to that moment. When that scene happens, they realize this is going to be a little bit tougher of a journey for the rest of it. It felt endless, not even endless. That's the wrong word. It felt like they were idiots to even walk away from the village because it was like, where are you going now? That was one section of the movie where I tightened things up. So that now they come out to the top of the mountain and they can see the ocean and you think they might make it and then they crash. It's a small thing, but it did allow me to shorten up some stuff in there. What I wanted to do was make sure the characters didn't feel like they were on a suicide mission to do that walk, that there was a goal. And if they buckled down, they might actually survive and make it. So that helped me tighten up some stuff." Ben Affleck's character was not always going to die in the movie. It was going to be someone else. Ben was the one who suggested his character die in a meeting with Chandor, which is a great idea. And it's the right idea for the story. And I think it's why Ben Affleck, who, whenever things aren't going great, like if Ben has a movie that, you know, people don't like or something, people love to pile on him. And I think he really is sort of like not respected enough as legitimately a great filmmaker. I remember back in the old days, you know, this is a long time ago, but there was this thing, this like joke floating around that somehow Matt Damon, like only Matt Damon wrote Good Will Hunting, and Ben Affleck was like sitting around like smoking a joint while Matt Damon was writing it. And Family Guy did what I just described as a joke, as a visual joke in an episode of Family Guy, if I remember correctly. And I think that's such bullshit. Like, it's really like, it's like offensive to me. I mean, I remember sitting in the theater watching Gone Baby Gone, which we did on the show, and just being blown away by it. And he's just somebody I really have a ton of respect for as a filmmaker, and I think is actually still slightly underrated. All right, so let's get into the movie. This is a very dense plot, but I'm going to very loosely summarize it. So we meet Pope. That's Oscar Isaac. He is a private military advisor in Colombia. He is supposedly combating drug crime, but the cops he's working with secretly work for the drug lord of the movie. And they also casually murder some prisoners at the beginning of the movie. So there's a lot of moral ambiguity going on. He is, you know, it's presumed basically that he's in a romantic relationship with this woman who is an informant. She's like an accountant for this drug lord. His name is Larea. and she wants Oscar Isaac's help to sneak her and her brother out of the country. And in exchange, she's going to help him, you know, capture, kill Larea and steal all this money from this house that he has in the middle of nowhere in the jungle where he's hidden millions and millions of dollars. Pope goes to the United States, recruits his former special ops buddies, which that's Ben Affleck's character, who's known as Red Fly, also known as Tom. And he is a realtor, technically. Then we have Ironhead, which is Charlie Hunnam's character, Benny, which is Garrett Hedlund's character, and Catfish, which is Pedro Pascal's character. And they all have sort of different things that they specialize in. Catfish is a helicopter pilot. Benny is an MMA fighter. Charlie Hunnam's character is a motivational speaker. I think my favorite part of the movie is really the stuff at the beginning with Affleck. So basically we meet Affleck and they all talk about him in these reverential tones. Charlie Hunnam basically says, "I'm not doing this unless you can get Red Fly." And, you know, it's clear that he was like their leader when they served, and they talk about him like he really is like the ultimate badass. And then we see him. He is a terrible real estate agent. He's giving a tour of the saddest like condo of all time. He's recently divorced. He goes to pick his daughter up and he's not allowed in the house. He's only allowed in the garage. And he gets a road beer from the garage refrigerator, picks up his daughter, goes to take her to school, tells her, "I love you." And she says, "I miss you." There's just a lot of really great stuff there that suggests like this whole sort of like sad turn that Affleck's character's life has gone. And I think it's really underrated as some of his best recent work as an actor. And I think it's, you know, I mean, The Way Back is basically this same movie, except instead of being an ex-soldier, he's an ex-basketball player. So they end up going to South America. They plan to move on this house while Larea's family attends church to minimize casualties. They do a recon. There's, again, another casual execution that's going on. And Oscar Isaac asks Charlie Hunnam, "Hey, are you at the tennis courts?" Like while they're murdering some prisoners of the drug lords. And Charlie Hunnam's like, "Yeah." And Oscar Isaac's like, "Oh yeah, that's his spot." And it's this moment again of like very casual moral ambiguity, because these guys could totally stop that execution from happening, but they never even consider it. They come back to do the actual operation. They subdue the guards, but they can't find Larea or the money. Pope realizes the money is in the walls and they find much more of it than they expected. They rush to pack as much as possible before Larea's family returns with more guards. Red Fly fixates on the money, demanding the team continue loading past the hard stop time he set until they convince him they must leave. This part is so good. You see that Affleck's character is like a genius, but he's also very self-destructive. And so as they keep going past, like he had set this hard out, they keep going past the time, keep going past the time. And eventually he's like, "No, we have time. I built in a cushion. It's 40 minutes to the church. It's 12 minutes from the church to the whatever." Like he has this whole little speech that, you know, is like maybe bullshit, but like maybe sort of right. And you could see where these guys would follow him, but also where like he's losing his mind. And the greatness of the movie is that you would think that Garrett Hedlund's character, who's depicted as this immature sort of cowboy kind of guy, you would think that would be he would be the one to be doing that. But instead, he's actually the voice of reason. He's the first one who's like, "Ben, like, what the hell are you doing, man?" Eventually, they sort of convince Ben, "All right, come on, we got to go." They get the money loaded in the truck. They end up finding Larea. They kill him, but he wounds Ironhead. And then the family comes back. Again, another great little moment. You know, you sort of see the family sees them, but like they don't know who they are. And they're going to obviously figure out who they are once they get there. The crew, you know, kills the guards, burns down the house, drives away with $250 million in cash, leaves the family alive. They rendezvous with Giovanna and her brother in an airfield, where Ironhead's contact provides them with a helicopter to reach the getaway boat off the coast of Peru. Catfish does not think the helicopter can hold their weight with all the money and reach the altitude necessary to cross the mountains. Unwilling to leave any money behind, Red Fly urges Catfish to proceed. They leave. They have the money in this giant net bag attached to the helicopter. They drop Giovanna and her brother off over the border, where Red Fly aggressively questions her knowledge of them because he knows that she's the only link between them and this robbery. She adamantly denies knowing any of the crew's personal information, and she says that Oscar Isaac told her that Ben Affleck's character was honest and would not cheat him. And it's like, it's almost like she punched Ben Affleck in the gut. Like he sort of stops for a second. And it reminds us of the audience, like, man, this guy has really fallen. Like at one time, this guy was like the most stand-up guy ever. And I think this is why Chandor's movies, in some cases, are not appreciated as much as I think they should be, because you really have to pay attention to like catch all this stuff. It's about all these little tiny moments. And, you know, now modern times, if you're checking your phone while you're watching this movie, you shouldn't even watch the movie. Like it's just one of those things where you have to actually watch to catch all this stuff. So before leaving, Pope gives Giovanna and her brother $3 million and visas to Australia. He urges them to leave South America immediately. This is another subtle way the movie is special, because usually in these kind of stories, the indigenous characters suffer the collateral damage. So like, you know, the more obvious version of this would be Giovanna ends up getting killed during the operation. Oscar Isaac is really pissed off. And that's, you know, the cost of it. Like that's sort of the, I would think, the more cliched way of doing it. But here, ultimately, it's actually the indigenous characters, the locals, that have the happiest ending. They get away with the money clean. Meanwhile, the Americans, who are sort of these foreign invaders, suffer terribly again and again and again. So the crew departs. Ben Affleck basically claims that Giovanna was lying and says, essentially, you know what we should have done, meaning that they should have killed Giovanna and her brother. That's clearly what he's saying. Charlie Hunnam replies and he goes, that's one you wouldn't have come back from. Again, that moral ambiguity, right? And I know, I mean, obviously, according to Vulture, maybe Tom Hanks wasn't actually ever attached to this movie, but can you imagine if this movie is, if that's Tom Hanks and Tom Hanks, like, hey, you know what we should have done? I think Tom Hanks should do a movie like that. Okay, we're going to take a quick break for a sponsor. We're going to be right back to discuss the end of this movie and also what Netflix is doing because of this movie, which is really pretty interesting. We are going to be right back. Movies I Love That No One Talks About is brought to you by Virtual Pitch Fest. Virtual Pitch Fest is a trusted industry source that specializes in connecting screenwriters with production companies and representatives. With Virtual Pitch Fest, writers can search through an online database, almost like a dating site, to see what 500 plus participating companies are looking for. They can then send short written pitches on their scripts to chosen companies with the assurance of a guaranteed response back. That's right, guaranteed, you get an answer, you get a fair shot. That's a really critical difference with this service compared to some of the other online pitch services for writers. To date, site connections have led to 150 plus success stories, including produced films. There's actually a Bruce Willis, Megan Fox movie that was recently produced directly because of Virtual Pitch Fest. Just a writer who, you know, was relatively unknown, went on there, did a pitch. The pitch was picked up by a producer, and then that ended up becoming this movie. There's also been dozens of other script deals, many writers landing representation. If this sounds like something that could be useful to you, check out Virtual Pitch Fest at virtualpitchfest.com. Okay, we are back. So the crew tries to fly over the mountains, but they kind of reach this maximum height where the weight is overwhelming the helicopter. This gearbox blows. They rapidly descend. Catfish urges the team to release the net bag of money to allow for a safe crash landing, which they end up, you know, they end up doing it and they survive. But this whole sequence is so tense and so cinematic. They try to release the bag. It doesn't work. They have to do this manual override. You know, somebody has to physically go and like release it and like almost like hang off the helicopter. When they're flying and trying to get over the mountain, it's like the helicopter crests the mountain and the sun hits their faces and you think, ah, maybe they'll actually get away. And then it sort of, you know, goes down. And all of this is shot in these beautiful sort of wide shots. And, you know, clearly it looks like a lot of this is done practically. It's very Nolan-esque. It's almost like you're waiting for Bane, like from that scene from the third Batman movie. Where Bane is just going to pop out of this helicopter at some point. He's going to be there with Channing Tatum. Redfly and Pope attempt to retrieve the money, which landed in a cocaine farm, by negotiating with the farmers of the village. Their attempts to peacefully recover the money fail when the farmers mistake the group for DEA agents. When one of the farmers approaches the machete, Redfly draws his pistol and kills him and several others. The remaining villagers scatter. Pope compensates a village elder, while Catfish, Ironhead, and Benny prepare mules to transport the money through the mountains. I listened to an interview with JC Tandor, and he said that he was really inspired by research when he talked to special ops soldiers and asked them what was the hardest thing they did. And they told him it would be these payoffs with locals where maybe there was some sort of a drone strike that, you know, went wrong and accidentally killed some civilians. And basically they would go and pay off these locals. And even in the meeting to do the payoff, they sort of could sense, hey, this money's coming back at us. Like, the people that we are trying to pay off are now radicalized against us, and they're going to come back and try to kill us. Again, you know, kind of a really subtle commentary on US foreign policy and all that kind of stuff. They take the mules over this steep path on the side of a mountain. One of the mules falls off. The money it was carrying goes flying into the air. Presumably millions and millions of dollars just kind of flutter off the side of this mountain. The depiction of the danger of the mountain path and like how they're like 2 inches from falling to their deaths was very, like, felt very real to me. I went to Costa Rica with my dad when I was younger, and we took this truck through a mountain, and the guy driving, I guess, did this every day. So it just was very comfortable. And I would look over the side of this truck, and I'm not exaggerating. It's like 6 inches, not even maybe 6 inches. And it's this giant truck, and the wheel is right there on the edge. And it's basically, if this guy goes a couple inches to the right, we're all going to die. And this reminded me of that a lot. They moved to the coast. Two of the villagers, you know, as expected, ambushed the crew. They essentially radicalized these villagers against them. And also the reason that they find them in part is because they make a fire, and they make a fire out of money. So again, the money is a curse on them. Redfly kills one of these villagers, but the second one kills him. And then Pope kills that guy. The crew then proceeds towards the ocean with the money in Redfly's body. Benny scouts ahead and reports the getaway boat is still there, but the town is filled with armed teenagers waiting for them. Oscar Isaac seriously considers that they should massacre these like 50 teenagers. The other guys talk him out of it. Knowing that they're not going to be able to sneak through with all this money, they toss what they can't carry into a ravine and carry where they can fit in their packs. Again, so interesting. Like, they keep having to get rid of more and more of the money. They just can't take it all. And you think, like, a heist movie, right? Like, you know, what other heist movie does that? Like, where it just like, it just, it's like it's cursed. So they keep having less and less and less. And it's like, is it a commentary thematically? Like, no one should have this much money, period. It's a movie that really makes you think. So they try to go quietly through the town carrying Redfly's body, but they're discovered. And then there's this kind of long chase sequence. And at the beginning, you see that some of the people chasing them are teenagers, which feels, again, like a commentary on child soldiers. After a car chase, they make it to the boat, and they've got $5 million left in Redfly's body. So they started with $250 million, and now they have $5 million. Imagine, is that ever going to happen in a Fast and Furious movie? You know, are we going to get imagine if, like, at the end of Fast Five, after they drag the safes, you know, through the streets, they're like, oh yeah, we lost like $200 million while we're at it. Then they set up an account with a lawyer to disseminate these funds, and I'm presumably like wash the money basically evenly between the four men and Redfly's family trust. All the guys feel really guilty, so they just give their shares to Redfly's family before they separate. You know, they kind of have a little, hey, what are you going to do talk. Pope plans to head to Australia to find Yovana. Before leaving, Ironhead gives Pope a set of coordinates on a piece of paper, and it's the location of the ravine where, you know, presumably they will go back for Triple Frontier 2, which is a movie that is never going to happen, and I will explain why. So IndieWire reported that Netflix planned to cut back on huge spending for movies specifically like Triple Frontier. Ted Sarandos responded and basically said that it was one of Netflix's most popular original films, watched by 63 million households. But he reportedly held a meeting with executives where he said Netflix was going to be more picky with spending on original productions, and that they need to prioritize movies that bring in huge numbers of viewers versus movies that are critically praised or get Netflix awards credibility. And according to this article, it came as a direct result of Triple Frontier basically being too expensive. Like, the bang versus the buck there did not line up. Triple Frontier supposedly was made for $115 million, which is a shit ton of money. And even I don't think it makes sense to spend that kind of money in this movie. I think the original Paramount budget of $60 million is probably the right budget. Personally, I would totally be happy if we had a steady stream of these movies in the $20 to $25 million range. I think there's definitely an audience for that sort of film. It's just not a $115 million movie audience. And if you read Chandor's script, like, you know, that's on the page. Like, this is not a mainstream movie. I think that, you know, what is sad about it is that it's a miscalculation that I feel like keeps happening, where it's like, hey, cool, we're making this movie. It's a movie for adults, whatever, you know, and then you make it a too high a budget. And it's like, if it's not the most successful movie ever, suddenly that becomes an indictment of making these kinds of movies. But this movie was never going to be for everyone. And, you know, it would be interesting to see if this had been a movie that they made for $40 million. And maybe, you know, maybe part of it also is pressure because of the cast, like that it's such a great cast and all that kind of thing. And I think it was also Netflix's original movie strategy and how many original movies they were pumping out and the sort of grandeur of those movies. This was a little bit earlier than that. So I think this was one that they just had a lot of pressure on it. And it was sort of like, again, like if everyone didn't love this movie, it's slightly considered a failure. And I think that's sort of very sad. I wanted to share some reviews of the movie. So look, I mean, the movie is positive on Rotten Tomatoes overall, right? Most critics gave it a positive review, but it's not like 99%. I mean, I think it's like 70%. So I kind of parsed through some of the top critics' reviews. And Peter Travers said, this Netflix action blowout gets a pass on mindless escapism, but its attempt to sell itself as something deeper is beyond redemption, which seems to me like wildly offensive. Like, I just don't understand what he's saying. It sounds like he's mad that Chandor tried to make a thoughtful movie. You know, in fairness to Peter Travers, the headline of his review calls Triple Frontier a mindless heist flick that delivers standard issue escapism, which is not even like that. I think that's even a more extreme statement than his actual review. I know sometimes the way this works is that an editor is the one who writes that headline, not like Peter Travers doesn't necessarily get to write it. And maybe that's what happened. But, you know, I read through his review and he basically accuses the movie of being hypocritical by trying to make the characters sympathetic. And I think that really misses the point. I mean, Chandor, I listened to an interview with him and he basically said, like, this, you're not supposed to like, these are not good people. Like, they murdered, I mean, look at the scene where they murdered the villagers, right? Like, the fact that they are human and have guilt means that they are complex characters. So like the idea that like, oh, we shouldn't sympathize with them, I just don't understand that. Like you can still sympathize with them while understanding that they are flawed people. Kenneth Turan of the LA Times said, Triple Frontier is a solid engrossing genre item with designs on being something more. It doesn't quite get there, but it does well enough along the way to make the journey worth taking. So that feels like a very fair review to me. I think that's, you know, I think my sense of it is that a good chunk of the audience had that reaction, which is fair. It's not gonna work for everybody. Todd McCarthy for The Hollywood Reporter said, despite the heavy dose of action and numerous tense situations, this Netflix offering has trouble staying in high gear once it gets there, and the characterizations remain one-dimensional. The men all speak exactly the same way. I think that is, in my opinion, that's demonstrably false. I mean, Garrett Hedlund's character is like this wild, like hoo-ah kind of cowboy guy. Oscar Isaac is very calm and strategic and thoughtful. Ben Affleck is like really like brooding and intense and self-destructive and kind of emotional. And, you know, I think they all are pretty different to me. Although I love Todd McCarthy and have a lot of respect for him. Manola Dargis for the New York Times said, working from a script that he rewrote, Chandor struggles to make the story's contradictions gel. They never do. So again, I don't understand that. Like, what is the contradiction of this movie? And I sort of read through her review and it seems like what she's saying is that it's a flaw that the movie purports that these characters are honorable. But again, like, I don't think it is purporting that they're honorable. I think it's basically saying these are people who've done a lot of horrible, horrible things and are morally conflicted about it, which is different from the movie trying to say, oh, you should think these people are honorable, which I don't think is what the movie is saying at all. Again, obviously, all this is just my opinion, to each his own. I'm really curious how much of my audience enjoyed this movie. Like, if you like this movie, like, send me a message or something. I really I think it's excellent, and I think it's even better on a second watch. And I'm really curious what Chandor is going to do next. He's doing this weird career arc where, you know, he does Margin Call, which I love so much. Margin Call is a great movie. And Margin Call manages to make something that seems like it should be boring, which is all this financial stuff. Totally fascinating. Then he does A Most Violent Year, which makes something that seems like it's going to be more viscerally exciting. And he sort of subverts it at every turn and makes it more thoughtful and thought-provoking and kind of a deeper thing than what you think it's going to be. Then he does Triple Frontier, and he does the same thing. It's a giant, big action movie, but he's still doing his thoughtful, thematically dense, sort of rich stuff. I think that something that is really interesting about Chandor as a filmmaker is that he's a guy that he doesn't really give you, as the audience, what you think you want. He kind of gives you something else. And depending on the audience, you're either going to like that and you're going to think, oh man, this is, I'm pleased that I'm surprised by this. Or you're going to be pissed off and you're going to be like, hey man, what the fuck? I thought this was, you know, I thought this was going to be like get her done. Kind of, these guys are going to just shoot up a bunch of stuff and it was going to be fun. I don't know. You know, I was sort of reading what he has coming, and I think he has a TV series coming. And I think that transition for him is probably inevitable, because television really lends itself to this sort of thoughtful, character-based, subversive kind of approach. And I think that there's, with television, you're really looking for a devoted core following, as opposed to, hey, everybody has to love this movie. I would be very surprised if Chandor, you know, I don't think Chandor is going to get to do like a Star Wars movie or something. But I am just really down for anything this guy wants to do, pretty much, you know, blank check, whatever he does, I'm there. I wish I could be his financier. That is our show for this week. So if you want to keep up with the show, join our Facebook group at Movies I Love That No One Talks About, or follow me on Instagram at Movies I Love That No One Talks About. If you dig the show, please leave me a 5-star review on iTunes. It's a huge help to the show. I really appreciate everyone who has done that. And if you're a monthly supporter of the show, feel free to request an episode at any time. I really enjoy kind of doing the episodes that the folks who listen to the show suggest. I have some really exciting ones coming up, actually, that I am going to keep quiet until I know for sure they're happening. But, you know, stay tuned. We have some really cool guests coming for future episodes of the show. Until next time, bye-bye.